Welcome to another edition of Pitt Bulletin Legal News Radio, part of the Pitt Bulletin Legal News Network. Broadcasting each Tuesday night at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the show covers the latest pit bull news across the country, including breed-specific legislation, the real story behind recently reported dog attacks, fact-checking on dogsbite.org, litigation updates, and a live call-in discussion. Call 646-595-4137 or join us in chat during the show.
Welcome to Pitbull Legal News Radio, February 17th, 2015. I'm your host, Fred Cray, with my co-host, Chris Brownsugar Diaz from Stop ESL, along with the rest of the PBLN crew, including Laura Hayes and Denise, who is in chat. Tonight, we're going to be discussing a very interesting topic. It's going to be legal in nature, but we're going to make it so that that you guys can understand it without a lot of legalese. We're going to talk about how to look at a breed discriminatory law and tell if it's constitutional. I have given several talks on this subject, and so you will be getting a free talk about this that I have charged other people for. I've got a PowerPoint that I'm going to be going off of. You won't see it, but I can because I'm omniscient and everything. So we'll be discussing that. We're going to take your calls at 646-595-4137. You can talk to Denise in chat by going to the Blog Talk Radio URL if you're listening live. If you're not listening live and you're listening to this on the Wednesday night, it won't do any good to go there because there won't be anybody in chat because the show's over. But you go in and log in with your Facebook credentials and talk to Denise. Denise has firmed up her wedding plans. I know this for a fact. Denise, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. So we've all decided on the show here that you're the expert on 50 Shades of Grey because you're the only one who's seen it. And we like to have people, you know, who actually know what they're talking about give opinions. What was your take on 50 Shades of Grey?
You mean I'm the only expert on this, on the Oscar-worthy performance?
I guess so.
Oscar-worthy.
You know, that has many connotations. You know, Oscar Mayer. Keep going. Go ahead.
I liked it, but I read the books and I enjoyed the books, and I thought the movie was actually better than the book. So,
in what way?
I just think that the characters were more relatable. Their acting was really great. I wasn't expecting that. And I think it touched more upon Christian Grey's character. It made him more, I guess you kind of understood why he is the way he is more so than you got from the book, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And that is my dissertation on 50 Shades. I'm glad I could contribute something.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what the show is. You know, we like to cover many different subjects, not just dogs. And, of course, you know, 50 Shades of Grey is on the national stage right now in terms of, I think, you know, probably will break. It's broken most of the records for attendance and so forth for that month and that weekend. But, you know, I just find that there are so many differing viewpoints of women about whether they're going to see it, whether they're not going to see it, what they think it's about, what they think it says about today's society, you know, what does it mean to sexual roles of men and women. It's just, to me, it's a constant source of discussion, you know, amongst everybody. It's like the water cooler discussion. But in the end, I think two things, even though I haven't seen it, I've read about it. My take on it is it's really a variation of a romance love story with a twist, which being, you know, the tying people up and stuff like that. And it's also something new and interesting, and everybody's always curious about the latest new thing, and particularly if it has to do with sex. You know, back in my day, the big deal like this was Deep Throat. You know, people waited in lines to see that. I mean, it changed the way society thought about the mores of the time, and You know, I think a lot of that, a lot of the things that that made that movie very popular, similar in the sense of it's new, it's something that is slightly taboo, and people, you know, would like to see it when it comes out in the open, how it looks and what it seems like, and delve into it. Chris, your thoughts, even though you haven't seen it.
Well, I think you're probably onto something with that, where it's something that people, most mainstream people, are not aware of. But at the same time, you know, I know some people who are into, you know, that sort of stuff, the bondage, and I forget what the letters are, BS,
S&M,
MD.
Not BS, S&M.
Something like that. And, you know, from what they say, it's a very, very, very bad representation of the lifestyle, and is borderline, like, abusive, that they wouldn't, you know, the way the character, and they've seen, I mean, they've seen it, I haven't, but they, you know, they've read the books and they saw the movie, and they were very, they were a little bit upset with the way it's portrayed, because, you know, everything in the community, when you're doing it right, is, even though it's like the actual act has a lot of discomfort to it, it's a lot about trust and it, about not breaking that trust. And
you always have your safe word. You have your safe word. To
yeah,
stop.
Exactly. And, you know,
I don't know anything about that. That's what I've read.
Knowing boundaries and, you know, really being able to put yourself in somebody's hands like that, that isn't going to abuse their position. And I've heard a lot of criticism that people are going to see this the way it's portrayed in the movie, and that they're going to try some of these things and that they're going to do it wrong, and it can cause a lot of emotional damage to people.
Well, interesting. I know that the movie is not very graphic in terms of that. I mean, it's suggested.
No, it's not.
I mean, it's not like you go there and go, oh, my God, I can't believe I saw that. I mean, it's very R-rated. I mean, my understanding is that it's not graphic. Laura, your thoughts before we close on this issue of the day that's burning in everyone's hearts.
I'm wondering why it has so much attention. I mean, is it just the addition of the kinky sex that makes it somehow scandalous and fascinating to people?
I think that's part of it. I do. I think that's a very big part of it. And I think also the other part of it is that people have read the books, and they were very well. A lot of people read the book and they wanted to see the movie. I mean, always. And you know, the other thing is that it really is a glorified romance. So
it is.
And so
a lot of the problems they're bringing up,
you know,
like
slightly
kind of like
abusive
in a
way.
It's much more typical of regular romance novels, you know.
Right. So I mean, I look at romance as women's porn. You know, they as much as guys like to watch porn, I think, you know, a lot of women like to read romance novels, and I think that both sexes are fantasizing about things that, you know, in reality aren't really what they are. But in any case, I think you
underestimate the standard pornographic consumption of females.
Well, that's probably true. You could. Why don't you address that, Chris? So anyway, the bottom line is that I think that this movie is a perfect storm, because it's got the, you know, a little bit of taboo. It's a sort of a, you know, the woman gets the man in the end thing, romance. So there's a lot going for it in that way. I mean, there aren't a lot of guys going to see it, I can tell you that, from what I've seen. So I get complete silence on that comment.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
The men that I saw there were dragged there. In fact, the couple next to me, it was a couple, and he's like, oh, my God, this is the great best movie ever. I'm so glad I came here. Like, completely sarcastic.
Right,
and,
right.
I mean, I guess you made some promises of what to expect when they got home that night. But
yeah, absolutely. So, and, you know, it might give you some ideas to try, you know. I mean, there was a movie out that was a little bit like this called 9 1/2 Weeks with Kim Basinger and Mickey Rourke, that was, you know, back in the day. Again, I'm dating myself, but it was also, it didn't have any kind of, it wasn't nearly, I mean, there wasn't a book, there wasn't, you know, it wasn't a huge line, but it was a pretty racy movie for its time. But all right, let's get into, you know, what we're really here about, which is 50 Shades of Grey. And let's talk about a recap of last week's show.
Previously on Pit Bulletin Legal News Radio.
Chris, your thoughts on last week's show?
Well, last week we spoke to Nancy Transow from Colorado Dogs about ballot measures and whether or not they are a good idea as a attempt to repeal a breed discriminatory law. And, you know, my sort of general thought about the topic is, you know, I'm very, very glad that we were able to discuss it because people do think that ballot measures are, you know, they think that they're going to be a lock. You know, they think that if they just put it on the ballot, that it's going to be repealed. But as we discussed last week, there are a lot of reasons why that's not true. And it's really important that people understand when they're considering something like this, that it isn't as simple as just getting the ballot measure out and people voting, that there's a lot more complicated issues that go on behind the scenes, culturally and politically.
And I think the bottom line that we, when we finally came to the, in a nutshell, it's not a good idea.
Yes, agreed. Agreed 100%. And Nancy also agreed after, especially after her experience with Aurora. And even, you know, even when they were going up to the ballot measure, she didn't, you know, she wasn't for it. It was a situation that they were put in. She was not, you know, that was not something that she wanted. It was a situation that they were basically forced into.
Yeah.
Yes. And therefore, you know, they didn't really have any option but to roll with it. But, you know, I think that they still managed to do a lot of good in the changes in poll numbers and the education and learning what messaging works for that community.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's do a little news because that's the next segment always. Do you have any breed discriminatory law news that you want to talk about, Chris?
I have a couple of little things.
Oh, okay, well, wait a minute then, because then that changes, you know, what we're doing here. Because we got to... And now, live from the PBLN Studios, it's Chris Diaz, Chris Brown Sugar Diaz from Stop BSL with her BSL BDL update. You know, BSL BDL, that could be like BSM, B&M, S&M, you know, there's all these acronyms being thrown around.
Yes, I suppose that's true.
She says in a
way. You always manage to tie the conversation back to, you know, the most relevant portions of the show. And it's a skill that just never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah. Okay, so go ahead.
So our first little piece of news here is Camdenton, Missouri. Yes. We had a little while ago, there was an issue in Camdenton with a woman who had two American Bulldogs. And They were targeted under the city's pit bull ban, even though American Bulldogs were not part of the ban, because the dogs met 5 of the 8 items on their visual identification checklist.
You should have your kisses on my list as the sound for that.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the more generic checklists that we've seen.
Right.
And, you know, only have 8 items. Basically, any dog with short hair is going to meet, you know, the significant portion of the items on this checklist. So, you know, she had been asking that the council reconsider the ban. And so on Tuesday, February 3rd, the board approved a new ordinance that it affects all of the dog owners under, you know, all the dog owners that live in Camdenton. They also reversed the ban on quote unquote pit bulls. So instead of a ban, they are now, it's a partial repeal. Instead of a ban, they now are declared potentially dangerous.
Yeah.
So
they have to be treated like dangerous dogs.
Yes. So they have to be put under restrictions, and people currently only are allowed to have one pit bull in their home at a time, and they also limit non-potentially dangerous dogs to three. Hmm. They are actually going to be revisiting this again. So tonight they will be revisiting it. They are looking to revise it to say that it shall be unlawful for more than three dogs to be kept located or harbored at a household. You know, that's the portion there, or the one pit bull dog. They are going to basically look at it and sort of fine tune some of this language because there were certain things they did not take into consideration.
Well, I know that Mark Webb was a lawyer there who I talked to, I think that's his name, and he had a court case going, and I think that may have had some impetus for what they're doing.
Yes, and if I'm not mistaken, I believe that was the owner of the American Bulldogs that he was representing.
Yeah. And he told me that the case went well for them, and, so I'm thinking that whenever that happens, they start thinking about their ordinance for.
Yes. And so our second little bit of information, I'm so terrible at these town names. It's really unfortunate.
Wauseon is what it looks like to me.
Thank you. Wauseon. Wauseon had initially voted, and they thought that they had voted to repeal their breed discriminatory law. It turned out that they actually didn't, because they have certain rules in place regarding how many votes over 50% or whatever you need. And because there was somebody wasn't present, and somebody abstained. So because of that, they ended up not actually meeting the necessary votes to repeal.
Yeah.
But they are continuing forward to try to get this law actually repealed. I do not have the results of the meeting. It's Monday. It's not this past Monday. It's this coming Monday. They will be discussing the ordinance that would remove restrictions on quote unquote pit bulls and pit bull mixes, and increases the strength of their generic dangerous dog law. So they will be visiting it again, and hopefully this time around, now that they know what is needed in order to actually repeal this, hopefully the votes will come in and they'll be able to get it done.
All right. Pretend that I played Second Time Around by Shalimar right there.
Okay. I will pretend.
All right.
But that's all for right now.
I have some stuff. I have some stuff to talk about. I'm not going to horn in on your action, but I've heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the final vote is supposed to be happening in Newark, Ohio, on their pit bull neutral law. And the guy whose name is Rath, who is the author of the bill, is trying to get it continued because one of the guys who's going to vote for it is in Thailand. So if he can't have that guy there, then they'll probably lose. So he's going to try to delay it. So we'll have to see how that comes out. And I also saw an article about Pawtucket. This really isn't about breed discriminatory laws like your thing, but let me play the news so that we can get back, so this can be in the right category. You don't want to be talking about something in the wrong category. But Pawtucket had an article in their local paper talking about that there had been no increase in bites since the ban was overturned last November. And that they said that they had 10 bites since then, and there are a variety of breeds, but the city is being stubborn, and they're saying, well, we're still deciding whether to appeal, which I don't understand how they can take this long to appeal. I mean, we talked to Dennis Tabula, some time ago. You usually have 30 days to appeal. I don't know how they could still be thinking about it, because they're worried that bites will go up when the weather gets better. I'm not making that up, as they said. So
bites go up when the weather gets nicer anyway.
Right, exactly. But that's what they're saying. The pit bulls are coming out. Pretend I played The Freaks Come Out at Night by whatever group did that song. So that came up in terms of you know, laws and, you know, how they're doing it. Also in the news, I guess one of the big things, one of the biggest news stories was the story that contained quotes from Colleen Lynn. It was an Associated Press article written about pit bulls as service dogs, and it started out, you know, with this guy who has has PTSD, and he has his service dog, and then it morphed into the paragraph reads, "But the program faces pushback," and then they say there are over 100 dog breeds that are more suitable will perform tasks to persons with disabilities and pit bulls, especially rescue pit bulls with unknown backgrounds, said. Who do you think said that?
Let me guess. That would be our good friend, Colleen.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then she went on to of course, you know, give her statistics from 2005 to 2014. Dog and cat attacks killed 326 people, according to data from them. And she blames pit bulls for 62% of the deaths. So that's kind of, I mean, even that statistic seems wrong to me, just mathematically.
Is she including
in
that definition, as they have been including, bull mastiffs, American bulldogs, kind
of
corsos, Doberman?
Of course they are.
You know, like,
who knows what they're doing? Only they know. That's the beauty of
yes.
it. So,
and apparently Malinois now are considered pit bulls by their group. So
right. So anyway, it's annoying that, you know, they have this thing, and it has like six paragraphs of, you know, all the great things about the pit bulls, and then of course they cite her and her statistics. And then there's the last sentence, you know, they go back to the guy who pit bulls have helped people like Bonafiglio, who is the guy who's the article's about, get back to their normal lives. The former Marine has made such progress with Zen, which is his pit bull service dog, that he's now taking cybersecurity classes at Mercy College in New York. So that story was, because it was an AP story, was a lot in the news all over the internet. But it was annoying to me. Of course, the Westminster Dog Show is on this tonight. They'll have Best in Breed. I heard on NPR that the guy who's judging Best in Breed being interviewed today, and he was asked, "Well, don't you know, what about the idea that, you know, that the dog shows have, you know, morphed dogs into unhealthy, fancy-looking dogs, and they can't do their jobs, and do you think it's time for you know, mixed breeds to get to Westminster?" And he just said, "No." That was
yeah.
So,
oh my.
So, some other stories. There was a dog that prevented somebody from being robbed, and it was interesting because they actually had the video of the attempted robbery, and the guy was, you know, sitting in his chair, and a guy came up to the door, and he opened the door, and the guy pulled out a gun, and the pit bull man just went, pew, and the guy took off running. So that was in Saco, Maine. The dog's name, of course, was Thor. How could he ever be beaten by anyone? There was also a story on Piglet, who was a very cute dog, I must say, and from the pictures, who was found on the freeway, and he found his way home by a picture that was posted by the police with his head sticking out the window. I don't know if you saw that picture. It was a beautiful picture. Then there was the sad story of Tank, who saved his 11-year-old girl and his family from a raccoon attack. But the raccoon had rabies, and now he has to be quarantined for 6 months because, you know, they don't want to end up like El Yeller and get rabies and infect everybody. So it's kind of a sad story. He's going to have to be in quarantine for 6 months, but the owners seem to be, you know, pretty much behind, you know, keep saying thank you, Tank. We're gonna have you put, you know, in the pound or wherever he's kept, or maybe he's in quarantine somewhere else. But you saved our daughter, who might have, since the raccoon was had rabies, from, you know, getting rabies. So that was a interesting thing. And then there, the last story I'm going to talk about has to do with Cesar Millan. You mentioned this last week about him being sued, and I wanted to see, you know, why he's being sued. And it's, Laura, you'll find this an interesting legal case, because the reason he's being sued, obviously, because he has a deep pocket. I mean, he and his rescue have a deep pocket. But the facts are according, and I, you know, obviously you never know what the true facts are, but the facts as reported are that this dog Gus had bitten somebody, and Caesar agreed to take him into his dog psychology center to rehab him. And the owner fell behind on his payments and removed the dog out of Caesar's dog psychology center, and then the dog bit somebody. And that person is now suing not only the person who took the dog out, but Caesar Milan and, you know, his whole group, because they're the deep pocket. And the statement from the dog psychology center was the dog was removed by the owner against strong objections by the trainer. My question, legal question is, I mean, if a guy is not paying to have you keep the dog and he comes to get it and you said, look, this really, this dog should not be out, you should continue to have him here and pay, what is the basis of liability for an owner who takes his dog out and doesn't pay? How what could Caesar Dog Psychology Center is supposed to keep the dog for free? Because, I mean, what do you think of this, Chris? What, your common sense idea about that?
I was under the impression that there was some sort of court order mandating that the dog be in the facility until he was cleared to go.
Yeah.
And that technically the owner couldn't just pull him.
Okay. So you're saying the court order would have prevented the owner from, and that would be that, you're right, that would be true. If there was a court order that said that, the court obviously felt that the owner was not could not alone make that choice.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as just generally your question about payment, and you know, that is a very strange situation, because you would think that you know, that they wouldn't be forced to continue to operate at a loss if the person, you know, doesn't pay. But I mean, I guess that they would just hold you know, hold custody of the dog until, you know, the financial or end of it is clarified and brought back up to speed. Maybe the way like a mechanic would hold your car until you pay. I don't know.
Well, they do that. I mean, vets do that. They'll hold your dog until you, and they'll say they have a lien on it, you know, and then you can't have it back until you pay. No, I think that's definitely something that boarding places do, and, you know, vets do, and everybody does, because that's the one way you can get paid. My question is, okay, if there's a court order, and you know there's a court order, I mean, if the Dog Psychology Center knew there was a court order, I think they'd have to keep the dog. I mean, you know, because...
I would think that they would have to as well, but...
But I will have to, we'll have to look into that story more deeply, because I, you know, that wasn't reported in the story I saw, but if you saw it, I believe you.
This was one of the original stories. Gus has had a bit of a history.
Yeah.
Even before this most recent attack, there he got into a fight with a dog at the center.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a gentleman, I don't know if it was his dog or not, but there was a videotape of it, of the, you know, the two dogs getting into a fight and the guy trying to intervene. I'm not sure if the guy who tried to intervene was hurt or not. So, I mean, he's been in the news quite a bit because he was very high profile and he went to Caesar Milan. And so this was one of the earlier stories that I had read. I believe this was right after the attack had taken place, which was, you know, some months ago.
Well, I think if there's a court order, there's going to be trouble for him for that. If there isn't, I wonder how that. I mean, if I'm training a dog and the owner wants it back and there isn't a court order, I don't think I can tell him you can't have your dog back. You can tell him, look, this dog isn't ready to be out, but the ownership of the dog is with the owner. But if there's a court order, that changes everything. All right. So let's go for station identification and come back with. Is your breed discriminatory law constitutional? How do you figure that out? And go into depth on that issue.
Pit Bulletin Legal News Radio is brought to you by the Pit Bulletin Legal News Network, the first and only network of pit bull-related information for owners, advocates, lawmakers, and the media. Visit our network of experts at www.pblnn.com for all things pit bull. Find news, upcoming and archived shows, statistics and studies, as well as ownership and advocacy information, all in one location. That's www.pblnn.com, the Pitt Bulletin Legal News Network.
All right, we're back. We're going to talk about the constitutionality of breed discriminatory laws. I wanted Chris to interview me, but I waited until the show to spring it on her. So, Chris, ask me a question.
How was your weekend?
Oh, that's funny. All right, so the question is, you know, you live in a place that has breed discriminatory laws. You know, how do you know whether your law is constitutional or not, and whether it's something that can really be enforced, or whether the city or county is just doing it like they did in Nulano because they can get away with it? And that's what we're going to cover here tonight. And feel free to call us at 646-595-4137 or talk to Denise through chat if you have any questions as we start out with this. I want to start out by talking about giving the history of breed discriminatory laws. They started out in the late 1980s. There was a hysteria that swept the country, starting with the Sports Illustrated cover of July 1987, which had this, you know, this very dangerous-looking, big teeth, growling pit bull on the cover that said, "Beware of this dog." Many places passed breed bans at that point, including, you know, Ohio and a lot of smaller places. And these cases that that were decided between 1989 and, let's say, 2000 are full of all of the false information that's been circulated about pit bulls from the very beginning, with locking jaws and, you know, all that kind of thing. And what you saw happening during that period in the case law was that courts were just saying, well, look at the preamble of the Miami law. We're going to accept all that as true and ban pit bulls in our jurisdiction. And unfortunately, you know, until recently, in the last, I would say 5 or 6 years, the case law was awful for pit bulls in terms of the cases that were out there decided, because what basically happened was, you know, your state government and city governments are allowed to, and county governments are allowed to regulate dogs through the police power, and the courts were doing everything they could, even in the face of clear idiocy, in my opinion, to uphold these pit bull bans. And so you get these cases from 1989, and you read them, and you go, "Oh, I can't believe they ruled that way." This started to change, you know, in the 2000s, and now we have some case law that has now changed the landscape and made it a lot more easy to constitutionally challenge these laws, not because of cases involving breed discrimination, but because cases involving dangerous dog laws. And when people have gone to challenge the classification of their dog as dangerous, there's case law that has developed around those issues that can now be and is being used by advocates in the breed discriminatory law context. So one of the things that's interesting is how the law discriminates. So the first distinction you have to, when you look at your law, you have to look at it and say, what is the law doing? Is it restricting my dog, or is it banning my dog? Those are the two things that it does. By restrictions, they can basically say that your pit bull is essentially a dangerous dog, and it's funny how they do it. I mean, I've seen pit bulls declared wild animals and therefore dangerous. They've been defined as hazardous, vicious, etc. So when they restrict the dog, you know, they basically say, okay, you have to have the dog on a muzzle when it's in public. You have to have liability insurance. You've got to have a yearly registration, have insurance, microchip, signage, and sometimes they'll have mandatory spay-neuter. Those are the various types of restrictions that breed discriminatory laws have, and that's the one area for restrictions. And then there are bannings, where they say you can't have, quote-unquote, a dog commonly known as pit bull, and they'll have various ways they define that. But generally, they'll either have a specific statute that names, you know, the breeds that they're talking about. And incidentally, there's a case, you know, back in the late 80s that says that the definition dog commonly known as pit bull is clear enough for people to know what it's talking about. Now, I mean, that flies in the face of what we know now about dog genetics, science, and also the fact that there is no such breed as pit bull. But these cases back in the late 80s and early 90s were stretching so hard to allow governments to regulate these dogs that they basically just upheld almost anything. You will find separate statutes. You will find that pit bulls are banned by, you know, slipping them into the dangerous dog definition or in a vicious dog definition or claiming that they're a nuisance, a wild animal, or hazardous. So these are all ways that they can the types of laws that they can use to ban a dog. Now, what's interesting is, you know, generally when you have a pit bull restriction or ban, the first question is, what's the definition of what's being the law is trying to define what it is that is being banned? And there are probably six or seven ways that the definitions go. You can have that the dog has a majority of the traits of three name breeds, the American Pit Bull Terrier, the American Staffordshire Terrier, and what's the third one, Chris? I'm trying to make sure you're awake.
I believe Staffordshire Bull Terrier is...
Okay, great. So your dog has to have a majority of the traits of those three breeds, a predominance of those breeds. Moses Lake Washington and Yakima, however you pronounce that, they have an element of the breed. Now, an element to me is a very broad use of the term. You know, does that mean 1%? You know, it's just so broad that the net that it throws out for definitions is way over inclusive.
So let me ask you a question real quick about that, where you're saying,
yeah, feel free,
you know, an element is 1%. Is there any case law or legal precedent that defines an element as being 1%?
No, it doesn't. There is no case law that defines element. There is a case that defines predominance, and that case is the City of Hearn versus Overland Park, I think. And in that case, they discuss a pit bull ban that in which the city defined, you know, within its policy that it would be 51%. And this is part of what they had in the Nulano case. They use the word predominance. And I think that most judges would, and the dictionary would say that it's 51%. Of course, the majority would be 51% also, at least. Some of the other definitions are, you know, the dog commonly known as pit bull, any cross or mixed breed. Of course, Miami uses the AKC and UKC standards and substantial conformance. And then there are, I don't know, two or three or four jurisdictions that use DNA testing. So those are the ways that different laws will define what kind of dog is being banned. So, for example, in Moses Lake, Washington, their definition was any dog, pit bull terrier, shall have herein be defined as any American pit bull terrier, Staffordshire bull terrier, or American Staffordshire Terrier breed of dog, which contains an element of its breeding, the breed of those three breeds. What that means, really, when we went to Moses Lake and deposed the people who were enforcing that, it meant 1%. So, you know, what you have to find out then is, how is the city defining? It may not be defined in the ordinance, but the guy who goes out and does the actual, you know, looking at the dog and making a decision has to have a way of defining an element. And in Moses Lake, their definition by, in terms of their course of practice, was 1%. So when you say when you look at the definition and you look at the wording of it, an element seems, I mean, just to the common person would seem to be not enough. I mean, what's the rational basis of having, for a law of having 1% pit bull and 99% lab? And I think I agree with that. I think that's one of the problems with an element. My first attack on that would be, what is the rational basis for that? There's no study or any kind of evidence scientifically or genetically that would show that a dog that has 1% of any of those three breeds has anything to do with those three breeds in terms of the way they look or the way they act. So that element has been upheld in a court in American in Yakima. I wanted you to know that was decided in 1989, which was the hysteria period, and there were no due process cases yet. The court found that it was not unconstitutionally vague, and here's what they said. They said, we concede that some inoffensive pit bulls might be banned as a result, but it was still a valid use of the police power. Now, one of the things about that case that needs to be pointed out is that the plaintiffs admitted their dogs were pit bulls. So it really was kind of a moot issue, because if you already admitted it, then you've admitted that there's an element. So one of the takeaways from that is, don't ever admit to animal control, if they come to get your dog, that your dog is of that breed. Now, Nulano, Louisiana, where we had that case, they used the word predominantly there. We never found out exactly what that meant, but the judge in the case clearly felt that it meant 51%. When the attorney from the town tried to argue that it was, you know, that it was, it didn't mean 51%. She actually said, "How do you figure that?" That was her exact words. So,
Were they arguing that it was? What percentage did the town attorney claim that predominantly was?
He was claiming that it could be 50%. Because you see, in the Nulano case, the DNA showed that our dog was 50%. And we said, look, under your own definition of predominantly, it's got to be 51%. Under your own law, the dog should not be banned.
Yes.
And so they were arguing, no, 50% is predominant. It's you know, if the rest of the breeds in the dog were, if you had 50% and the other part was 49 and there was one, it was the predominant breed. It was the most of the breed. And by that by that reasoning, if you had a dog that was, 40% pit bull, one of the pit bull breeds, 40%, 39% another breed, and whatever the rest of that 100% would be, that 40% would represent predominant under their definition. So,
what I'm sort of getting is that, like, one of the first things that a person should look at to determine the constitutional weaknesses of an ordinance would be the definition, like how they're defining.
Yes, and the more
the percentage of breed, and in what portion of the ordinance, like you said, sometimes it's a nuisance, sometimes it's wild animals.
Right, but it would be
the
definition section is where they usually define what that means. And, I would say if it has an element, or any dog known as pit bull, or any of those kinds of things, that, the question has to be raised whether or not that has a rational basis to the state's purpose in protecting the public from dangerous dogs, which is what this is supposed to be about. So that's one of the issues that you have to think about. The other question you have to ask yourself is there a DNA test involved? If there is, the question then becomes, is DNA admissible in court? And if it is, how would you introduce it without somebody from, let's say, Mars coming to say that test was done in a way that meets legal qualifications of the Fry-Daubert test, which is a test that says, you can't just bring junk science into court. You have to have it's like DNA for O.J. Simpson. You wouldn't expect him to be a guy to come into court with O.J.'s case and say, look, I had this lab test from a guy at the lab, and it says here that he did it. Here's his DNA, but I'm not going to have the guy from the lab come and tell you how it was done. That would never work, and that's because Fry-Daubert would require someone to lay a foundation to show that the DNA is accurate and it's been tested scientifically so that that there's some showing that it's, accurate more likely than not. So the problem with that is that in the Mars test, it specifically says, you can't use this in court. So the other example that we use is, you know, the substantially conform to the AKC or UKC standards. The problem there is that's been upheld by the courts in the Miami case. But the question you have to ask, the truth is that the AKC and UKC are against breed discriminatory laws, and they have actually testified that their standards are not meant to determine breed by visual identification. So even though this has been upheld in court, I think that there's still room for, you know, doubt as to whether or not that definition meets the rational basis test, because those standards are not meant for that purpose. And if you ask the American Kennel Club, in one of the cases that came out of Miami, they asked one of the AKC guys, I don't remember what his name was, you know, are these standards meant to define breed? And the guy said, I couldn't tell you if Lassie were a collie without looking at his pedigree. So even if that's the substantially conform language, I think is still really vague, but it's not. These rational basis issues are the hardest to prove in court, because you have to have, it's expensive. They did it in Diaz versus the City of Denver, and it took 5 years to get to the point where they had a summary judgment motion on whether it was a factual issue or not. It's much easier to defeat a breed discriminatory law on the issue of due process, which is what we did in the Nulano case. So what you have to look for is, first, does the law provide a challenge to the government's classification as for the dog being classified as a pit bull? It must. If they're going to classify your dog as a pit bull, you have to have a hearing where you have the right to counsel, the right to cross-examine witnesses, the right to some discovery if you need it, with a burden of proof that you know what it is, and you know, notice of the hearing and the right to defend yourself. Now, the question is, so a lot of places don't have that. I mean, a lot of the laws that I've looked at, you know, basically the animal control officer says your dog's a pit bull, and now you have to appeal that. And the presumption is that your dog is a pit bull, and then they can't put the burden of proof on you on appeal to prove it's not. In other words, it's like a criminal case. You know, they have to make their case in a hearing, and the burden's on them to go forward. If you go to the hearing and show up and they don't have any evidence, you go home. You're free. It's just like a traffic ticket. If the cop doesn't show up, you go home, the case is dismissed. But a lot of pit bull ordinances try to sort of say, well, if the animal control officer thinks your dog's a pit bull, now the burden's on you to come in and prove it's not. No, it's not. And that's, if your ordinance does not contain a hearing, it doesn't contain a right for you to come and have a hearing and defend that classification, then it's unconstitutional. And that's the first due process issue you look at, and it's usually the one that's the easiest to prove, because there are many cases in the dangerous dog law context that you can apply to this issue, and it's a pretty open and shut case, because the law is clear. The law is clear that you're entitled to that, and they can't. Another thing that laws do, and they do this in Reynoldsburg, and I think it's going to be a question of one of the things that gets brought up about theirs, is they can't make you become a defendant in a criminal case and make you defend the classification with you being charged as a criminal. It's got to be separate from that. So they can't say, well, your right to defend your dog as a pit bull is at the hearing where you're criminally arrested for keeping a pit bull in your house. No, they can't do that. They can't make you become a criminal defendant in order to contest the classification. So the fact that you get a hearing in a criminal court about your ticket that you've got a dangerous dog, if it doesn't have a separate way for you to challenge that classification other than becoming a criminal defendant, then it doesn't meet due process. And there's a case right on point that comes out of Ohio. I'm not going to get into the actual names of the cases. Just take my word for it that there are, you know, five or six cases that say that, you know, you have to have a hearing, you have to have notice of hearing, you have the right to counsel, you have the right to cross-examine, you have to know the burden of proof. The burden of proof is on the government, and, you know, they have the burden to go forward. And if they don't, your dog can't be classified that way.
That seems to be a very common thing where they put the burden of proof on the owner.
It does.
To prove that it's not. Like, I am not familiar, actually, with any law at this point in time that puts the burden of proof on the government.
It has to be on the government to prove it. And when you go to court, if the animal, you know, it's up to the animal control officer or the veterinarian or somebody to come forward with evidence to show that they can prove their case. It's like, you know, anything else. They're taking away your property. They have the burden of proof. It's a criminal case. The burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. If it's a quasi-judicial or, a civil infraction, it's preponderance of the evidence, which is 51%. Okay, so the first question is, you know, do you have the hearing issue involved? And if it doesn't, and is your hearing, is it in a place where you're a criminal defendant? If it has those two things, that's a very strong argument to get that overturned. The second procedural due process issue is, does it require an owner to pay to have a hearing? You can't do that. You can't say, okay, we're arresting you for having a pit bull. If you want to appeal this, you got to pay $200 to have a hearing. Can't do it. Just like in Nulano, it was improper for them to say, if you want to contest your dog's determination, you have to pay $200 for a DNA test. You can't do that. Because if you don't have any money, you get convicted because you don't have any money. And our criminal justice system and our property justice system is not such that people should be required to pay. Can you imagine if you got a traffic ticket and somebody said, okay, I'm giving you this traffic ticket. I saw you going 79 and a 60. And if you want to contest this, you got to pay me $100 to have my radar detector calibrated. Would we say that was okay? No, we'd say you can't do that. So if there's any kind of fee associated with the contesting of your hearing, your classification, whether it be for a DNA test or whether it be to pay, you know, a hearing examiner to be, to listen to your case, those things are not allowed. There's a case called Downey versus Pierce where they said that requiring an owner to pay $125 fee to have your first tier evidentiary hearing was violated due process and your right to access to the courts. So that's the second due process thing. The third way is looking at the definition. We talked about this earlier. Is it so vague that a person of ordinary intelligence could not determine whether or not they were breaking the law? It's hard to win this argument because the law makes it a very high hurdle. You have to prove that it's vague in every application, which is difficult. The case is United States versus Salerno. There were two cases that have found pit bull bans vague: American Dog Owners Association versus the City of Lynn, and it was in during the hysteria period, 1989. The Massachusetts Supreme Court held that an ordinance which defined a pit bull as an American Staffordshire pit bull terrier, bull terrier, or any mixture thereof was unconstitutionally vague. Now, so my argument is to take that case, Smith versus Toledo, which was a case where animal control found a Connie Corso was a pit bull. Those two cases, I use those as leverage to say, well, look, you know, if you have a dog, you know, that's how is a dog owner to know whether he has a pit bull or not? And, you know, what they'll say is, well, everybody, there's a ton of cases that say, look, if you have a dog, you got to know what it is. You can look it up in the dictionary. You can look at it in the Encyclopedia of Dogs. My argument to the void for vagueness thing now is a science argument. And that is that it's impossible now. One of my arguments in the Nulano case, it never got reached because of the issue of due process. But my argument is there's no way to identify legally a pit bull. You can't do it with DNA because they'll never testify as to the authenticity of the Mars Wisdom Test. And you can't do it by visual identification because Victoria Voith has shown that that doesn't work. And all these other ways that they've done it, using the AKC standards, the UKC standards, none of them have met the Fry-Dauber test, which is I identified a pit bull, and then I tested it, and I found it was right. And I used the Miami versus the Cardell versus the city of the county of Dade County, where they said that, you know, identifying a dog by visual identification as a pit bull requires expertise, and it requires you to show that you've got data. The data was compared, you know, you've compared your identifications so you know which ones were right and which ones were wrong, and that, you know, you can prove that there's a track record that, you know, you have done it correctly. Think about, you know, a dog that sniffs drugs. When you try to introduce that evidence, you've got to prove that dog has a track record of sniffing drugs correctly. Otherwise, it becomes, well, my dog alerted, and every time he alerts, you know, you have probable cause to search. If he just alerts every time, then how do you have probable cause if you can't show the dog knows how to alert only to drugs? Do you understand what I'm saying, Chris?
Yes.
Okay, good, because it sounds kind of confusing. But the point is, if nobody can legally identify a pit bull, how can an owner know? And my argument in the definition void for vagueness issue is that argument that you can't identify a pit bull legally in any way, either through DNA or visual ID. And so my argument is that if that can't be done, how can an owner know that he's violating the law? Now, that hasn't been tested in court yet. Although I will say the judge in the Nulano case, they had a definition that said, you know, the dog had to be predominantly pit bull, but under the DNA definition, they said if your dog is of any pit bull breed, and the judge looked at those two definitions and said, I have no idea what this means. This is so void, I can't even understand it myself. So, you know, sometimes the definition itself, you can just look at it and say, hey, if you've got two different definitions, you know, one says predominant and the other one says any, right away, that's one I think you'll win, because you can't have all these different definitions in one place and know what they're talking about. So, any questions, anybody? It's Chris or Laura.
No. So far, I think I'm understanding pretty well, and, you know, it's really good information. Laura,
yeah, anybody
had asked something about notice. Why doesn't she can, you know, she can specify what she means by notice. So, Laura, go ahead.
That's like the legal requirement. The law has to apprise people of what behavior is prohibited.
Yeah, that's
like the one statute we looked at where it was so unclear that maybe a dog owner who had gone to look at the ordinances wouldn't really be sure what was going on.
Well, that was the Nulano case. That was the Nulano ordinance where in the one part they said your dog has to be predominantly of those three breeds, and then it said, okay, if you disagree that your dog is one of them, we're going to give you a DNA test, and if the DNA test comes back that your dog is of any pit bull breed, and you can't. Those are two definitions that are totally different. One is 51%, and one is 1%, and so, you know, there's no way those two definitions. How could you know if your dog is 1%? That's my problem.
That's something that I don't think we covered in the definition portion. It's conflicting definitions within the
right.
same law.
Exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's definitely something that's a problem for the definition system section is important because it defines what it is that's prohibited. And if you can't, if there's multiple definitions and they're different standards, it makes it easier to challenge it. And I think personally that, you know, when you get to the point where you're talking about, I think any definition that says any mixed breed, any of the above breeds and any mixed percentage is one that can be challenged, because what does that mean? Any mixed, if it's of any mixture of the above three breeds, that means it could be 1%, of one of those breeds, and that means it's banned. I just don't think that. I think that under the science and law that we have now, that challenge should be made, because I just don't think the average person. I mean, the question is, how do you know you're breaking the law?
You have a Catahoula or an American Bulldog.
Exactly. And then we've had cases where they've had a Connie Corso. In Smith versus Toledo, the guy had Connie Corsos, and the judge said that. And he, you know, it was clear they weren't pit bulls. And so he found that definition that they had of any mixture thereof or whatever. And they're always trying to cover their ass in these definitions in some way. Like, well, it doesn't have to be, if there's something technically incorrect, it won't invalidate the classification. I just don't think that in today's scientific world that we can say that fixes the problem. So, all right. So let me move on here so that we can finish up with this and go on to the Canadian weather. The next question you have to ask yourself is, does the ordinance violate equal protection? And that means, does the ordinance treat all dogs as equal? And there has been no court that I have seen that has found that breed discrimination laws violate equal protection. But I will say that I thought we had a good argument in the Nulano case, because they use DNA as the for the appeal, if you want to call it that. And the Mars Wisdom Test doesn't contain one of the three breeds that's involved. So what your argument in that case would be, look, we've got three different breeds of dogs that you're banning, but we're treating one of them differently for no reason other than it's not in the Mars database. And that violates equal protection, and I think you would win that case. Equal protection is a tough one. The other issue that you can look at is whether the ordinance allows for the warrantless seizure of dogs. I mean, in other words, can they come, if you're walking your dog, can an animal control officer come up and say, hey, you got a pit bull, I'm taking it right now. They take it out of your hands without probable cause, or they come to your house and they say, I want your dog, and without your consent, they come in and take it. Those things aren't proper. Unless there's exigent circumstances, animal control cannot come in to your house. Actually, animal control many times has no police power. They have to actually call the police to have them come in and get the dog. But that's also an avenue that has not been reached in most cases. I brought it up in Nulano. We never got to it because the other issues were stronger. And finally, the last issue to be considered is the rational basis test, which is, does this law meet the requirement? You can't take someone's property without there being a problem that you're trying to address. So you can't ban pit bulls in your town unless there's evidence that there's a the pit bulls bite more, they've had problems with pit bulls. There's the case in Clay, Alabama, was a great illustrator of this. I think it's Schreiber versus the city of Clay. And the city of Clay's position was that they banned pit bulls because the city manager had read about it in the newspaper, how dangerous pit bulls were. And they actually went to trial on this issue. And the city of Clay called the city manager, who said, yes, I did read about it in the newspaper. And this is all in the case. You can read if you want. Email me and I'll send it to you. And what they did was, the city of Clay called, the guy from the next county and said, yeah, we've had trouble with pit bulls. And a guy from another city that was not their, their city saying, and the court held, look, if you're going to take people's property because the dog hasn't done anything and it's not dangerous, if you're going to do that, you've got to have a rational basis. And it's not a rational basis to read about it in the paper. And so the last case to talk about this was Diaz versus the city of Denver. And in that case, they had five or six experts that said breed-specific laws do not increase public safety. They don't decrease, overall dog bites. Pit bulls aren't more dangerous. You can't tell a pit bull by identifying it visually. They had all those experts. And basically, the city of Denver had Arnold Beck. And they went up to the Tenth Circuit, and the Tenth Circuit said, look, based on this record, I don't know if it's a rational basis or not. It's for the jury to decide. So the problem with the rational basis test is, it's an expensive case to put on. You have to have experts. It's a question of fact. So it's up in the air whether you can win that. You're much better off with due process, the hearing issues, and all those other things. They're pretty much legal issues that can be decided without any facts. If you have an ordinance that doesn't allow for a hearing on a classification, that can be overturned, you know, quickly and with very little cost by just filing an injunction and saying, look, this doesn't allow this, citing the cases, and then, you know, they're going to have to change it. So thus ends my little talk about whether your breed discriminatory laws are constitutional and how you look at one and whether or not they are what the basis are that you can look at to see whether they're constitutional. Do you have any questions, Laura?
No, I think you have a pretty good billion depth coverage of that. And
all right, Chris?
No, it was, you explained things in terms I think people will be able to understand very easily.
All right. So if you haven't been a live listener, you can listen to this at any time. As soon as the show goes off the air, it's automatically archived. Tell your friends, tell your lawyer friends particularly that if they want to know, what the law, how to go about looking at and analyzing this to listen to that part of the show. And if they want to have a question, they can email me and I can send them law. But I know all that was pretty boring. But, you know, some things that are important are boring, you know, so that's just how life is. Some things that you need to know are boring. But now we're really going to get into the exciting part of the show because we have on the always Canadian, always sultry, and always being able to bring back the topic to dog training, Yvette Van Veen.
And the beat goes on.
So, Yvette, everybody wants to know if 50 Shades of Grey is as popular in Canada as it is in the United States.
I don't know. I haven't even read the book, but I see it everywhere, so I'm assuming
it must
be.
You must read the news. I mean,
I do. I saw the book in the bookstore and stuff. So if I've seen it around, then it must be pretty popular, right? You know.
Well, that's scientific opinion.
Yeah.
So the question.
Well, I'm just saying, it's like, I mean, it's got to kind of beat me over the head where it's like, oh yeah, it's I've seen the controversy on some of the Facebook pages about it.
Well, Chris wanted to ask you, if there are any training techniques from 50 Shades of Grey that you could use for your dogs.
I have
I
no clue.
Okay.
And so I said, Chris, I don't know. I think that's a great topic for Yvette.
That's a horrible
Let's
topic for Yvette, because the only way I can bring that back onto topic is saying, I don't know, did they use dog collars? Because if they did, then we could talk about how to use dog collars.
Well, I don't know. Let's ask Denise that, because she's the one who would know. Denise, did they use dog collars in 50 Shades of Grey?
No, they used whips.
Oh, okay.
So, well,
that's not
a horse trainer.
Like
I don't know.
That's not appropriate, I don't think.
Yeah, that doesn't, that doesn't sound force-free to me, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right, so I guess we can't tie that in any way, Yvette.
The whip thing? No. I don't see the need for that.
Well, I guess you could dress your dog up in 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah,
like
you
Chris.
Could. That would be interesting.
I guess. Technically,
she doesn't. Chris doesn't sound too enthusiastic about this whole 50 Shades of Grey thing.
Nah, it's a little out of my,
There's only one of two. There's only two reasons to not be excited about it. One is, you've already done it and it's boring to you. Is that what's going on?
Sure.
I knew it. All right.
See, I want to know is how come Fred is the expert on this topic.
I'm not an expert. I'm the least expert because I'm a man. You know, I don't
think this has an overabundance of curiosity relating to the topic at hand.
No, what I'm interested in is women's reactions to it. That's really what interests me is because it runs such a gamut. You know, you think that they'll be. I mean, if I've talked to let's say 30 women, I've gotten 20 different opinions. I mean, it's very interesting how fragmented the whole thing is, you know. So that's what interests me is all the different, and it's a conversation starter, you know. When you're out on a date, and you say, "Now, were you in 50 Shades of Grey?"
I'd say that's a conversation
that's a,
ender.
That's a conversation starter, you know, because don't you think? I think this is going to be good. Okay, so What is our topic tonight, Chris? Other than Shades of Grey.
Yes. Our dog-related topic for this evening is when you're adding a new dog to your household.
Okay.
You want a dog that's going to mesh with your lifestyle, and obviously you want a dog that's going to mesh well with a current dog.
Mm-hmm.
What are some things that people should look for when they are considering bringing another dog into their house?
Oh, okay. So when they're out shopping around, basically. Okay. So not what to do after, but sort of as you're making your wish list up and you're meeting different dogs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I'd say the first thing is to really honestly understand your own dog and what their strengths and weaknesses and play styles are like. So if you happen to know that you have a dog that has a tendency towards resource guarding, it would be foolish to bring in another resource guarder, because then you have two dogs that are sort of fighting over the same resource potentially, which makes the problem much more difficult to deal with, you know, or a dog that is too much in the face of the other dog, right? So if you have a dog that's, you know, maybe you've worked with them and they're pretty good with their bones and stuff, but it's far easier to deal with a dog that's maybe a little bit more respectful of boundaries than one that's constantly getting the other dog's face. It's almost like you're saying, okay, I'm going to pick the one that doesn't antagonize my dog's problems so I can continue to work on them. So you're trying to find that dog that sort of meshes well and vibes off your dog well. You know, and you also want to think of it in terms of, play style. So if you have a dog that loves to run laps around the yard, you may perhaps want to rethink something like a dog that's got that predatory chase, or maybe even that herding, nipping, sort of, I'm going to, you know, bite at your flanks, because the dog that's running isn't going to enjoy that in terms of play style. But they might either do well with a dog that, maybe a dog that likes to play tennis, you know, one dog's running around, the other one's chasing a ball, where their play styles work, they're complementary.
Also,
so I
think
the first
think about
step
the dog's
is understanding
too.
What your dog is, so then you can start making a list of, these are the types of behaviors that irritate my dog, and these are the types of behaviors in another dog that they seem to do well with. So that starts narrowing the focus down substantially.
The age of the dog, too, because you don't want to get a really old dog and have a really young dog that antagonizes the old dog.
Right, that can happen as well, and that's really uncomfortable to deal with. We went through that a little bit with our former dog, Kiki, and then we got Kip. And Kip was just, odd. Odd, nasty, I don't know. There's so many words to describe Kip, it's not even funny.
He could have been in 50 Shades of Grey, because I remember his nickname.
There we go, brought it back.
He's reformed.
He's reformed.
There you go. So I didn't say it.
But I clearly remember when the first day we brought Kip home, he was 4 weeks old, which I remember rescue situation. So, I mean, I understand that's not something you would strive for. And he came to us for fostering. And we had Kiki, and she was healthy at the time, but she was, 14. And normally with puppies that are 4 weeks old, they're sort of waddling around and you're not expecting it to be that bad. And he kept going after her face. It was just this, when you sort of sit back and go, how is this possible? Like, this is just so awful. And he's the type of dog that even if she were to snark at him and say, I'm not appreciative of this, he'd just kind of shake it off and go, fine, let's do that again. And so again, that sort of bad match, and it's a very guilt-ridden place to come from if you're making that decision to introduce that dog to your home, because then it starts leading into the constant supervision, the crate and rotate, and you feel like you're failing the older dog or abandoning them when you're spending time with the puppy, and then you feel like you're not meeting the needs of the puppy if you're giving attention to the senior dog. It's a very emotional roller coaster ride to do something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I got Barney. I got him when the person who had him said, she had a collie that was 14 and Barney was, he's one of those kind of dogs. And he just pestered this dog to death, and finally they said, if you don't come get him, I'm taking him to the pound.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was that exact situation, and ever since that time, when there's sort of an idea that if you have an older dog and you get a younger dog, the younger dog will pep the older dog up, and that may be true, you know, in some situations, but it also may be true that that older dog is annoyed and almost, you know, has a nervous breakdown because the young dog won't leave him alone.
Right, exactly. And it can definitely make people feel guilty, and it can also taint the relationship with the new pup. So with us, I mean, we were fostering Kip, and then we decided to keep him, and we did do a lot of crate and rotate, and Kiki passed away about 6 months after Kip got to us. And it makes you feel like crap. There's no other way to explain it,
yeah.
Where you just feel like nothing you could have done would ever be good enough.
Yeah.
And we kept Kip because he was such a nasty, you know, like he was such a challenging pup. There was also an element of, you know, who's going to want this dog and, you know, is he going to survive in the average home? So it was like a guilt decision versus a guilt decision versus a guilt decision, which is never the strongest place to come from when you're bringing a dog into the home, is the guilt decisions, because they're not always the right ones. Now, I'm not saying Kip has worked out fabulous. It has nothing to do with Kip. You know, like he decoys in my classes now. He's fantastic. He's, you know, lying across the room from me. You know, he's just lovely now. But, at the time, it was emotionally very charged.
So when, as far as ages go, I mean, let's say you have kind of, not like a young dog, but like two or three, you know, four or somewhere, young-ish still.
Yep.
I mean, is it better to get a dog who is, you know, that same general age? Or, I mean, do you want, like, I know a lot of people say they have a 2 or 3 year old dog and, you know, they get a puppy. But, you know, if you're not specifically looking for a puppy, I mean, are there advantages to having the dogs being around the same age?
I think you're better off looking at it from best match rather than looking at it in an age perspective, because if they get along, they get along and life is really nice and easy. I think it's probably best to go at it that way. The age thing, I think we like to try and get that crystal ball out and say, you know, well, if there's, and I've done this too, I mean, where you say, well, if there's 2 to 3, 4 years between them, then when they hit their senior years, you know, we can, you know, the medical bills won't hit us all at the same time, you know, and you start to try and plan strategically, and I just don't find life tends to pan out that way. And so you might as well just sort of live a little bit more in the moment and say, these two belong together. They're great buds. And I mean, anybody who's been on my Facebook page sees pictures of Kip and Karma together. And I mean, I think the last one I posted, Karma's got her paw wrapped around in Kip's neck and they're cuddling up together. And I think that's sort of the picture that people have in their minds of, you know, when they have multiple dogs, is the dogs get along, you know, like they're friends. So I think,
yeah,
I would aim for that rather than trying to put an age limit on it. And if it happens to be that they're the same age, great. And if not, great, because it's the, mm-hmm, paw around the neck. That sort of, you know, we get along,
yeah,
we're friends. I think that's what people are looking for.
I mean,
maybe they aren't, but that's what I'm looking for.
One of the things we did when we got our greyhound was we took our dog out to the greyhound place and let the dog interact with the different greyhounds, and there was a lot of difference. You know, we picked the one that was the most mellow and didn't hassle the dog, and it turned out to be a good way to do it.
Yep, yep. And a lot of people do foster to adopt.
Yeah.
So what they'll,
yeah,
do is they'll bring in a foster dog, and let's say it turns out to be like that sort of crate and rotate situation. You know, it's temporary then.
Yeah.
And you're still helping,
yeah,
the dog out, and they get their permanent home someplace else, and they're,
yeah,
happy.
Yeah.
And when you hit that dog that just belongs, you go, guess what, buddy, you're not leaving. And you know. And that's not a bad thing to do. And if there's a real severe clash, where you say this is dangerous for one dog or the other, if you're working with a reputable rescue or shelter, they're going to say, no, we need to move this dog into a different environment. So you have that safety net in there as well. So if you have those types of concerns, there are options to work around situations that way, especially if you have that strong support system around you. And I strongly encourage people to take advantage of stuff like that, because you might end up helping five dogs along the way, but then once you find that one that belongs at your house, you'll also be helping that sixth one to have a really happy life.
Yeah. And one of the things that I see all the time is people saying, talking about the gender of the dogs. I see a lot of recommendations against having two female dogs. You know, people saying that you should have, I guess, like a boy and a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Is it overemphasized? Is gender in multi-dog households overemphasized as a factor?
I have always done the male-female thing. I think it works out really well. I think...
So now we're bringing it back to 50 Shades of Grey, then.
Mm-hmm. You're so dirty.
Only in your mind, Fred.
I think if you ask any trainer that has been doing training for a long time, I think you will you'll hear them talk about situations where females don't get along, and they're typically, well, they're called bitch wars. And when they happen, they can get nasty and ugly, and I think that's what people have in their minds when they say, you know what, if you only have two dogs, a male and a female is probably your best bet. So I don't think it's a bad thing, as long as your first rule of thumb is, do they get along? But that idea of once you get that sort of fighting in the house where the females are really, and I don't know why it tends to be just the females are the ones that sort of get labeled as that, but it can be a problem. And I think most trainers that see a lot of dogs, they'll sort of say, yeah, every so often they get a couple dogs of the same sex that really go at each other. And it's not common, but when it does happen, it's really ugly. So, I mean, but I don't think...
in relationship to females mostly. I never see it, like people talking about, that same type of issue with two males. I only see it in reference to females.
Exactly. Well, I mean, that's why they're called bitch wars, right? So I'm not sure. Now, if there's two dogs that really got along well and they happen to be female, you know, or you see people that have four, five, six dogs, you know, same. Obviously, some of those are going to be same sex. So it doesn't necessarily mean that if you have two dogs of the same sex, they're guaranteed that they're going to fight. But it's, you know, for the average pet home, I like the male-female mix. It seems to work well for most people, as long as the first priority is that do these dogs have that sort of the personalities, the temperaments that play well off each other.
Aren't you worried they're going to fall in love?
No.
Not if they're fixed.
I was going to say fixed, not fixed. I mean, the one thing with the males, yeah, I think there's the preconception they're not interested if they're fixed. But we sort of had a little rude awakening there because it's, why would I care if they fall in love? Why do I care?
Well, maybe it would take, you know.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a good thing?
Yeah. I want the dogs to get along. I think what sometimes freaks people out is, I think the other thing to be more concerned about is the size difference. You know, if somebody says, let's say they have...
I thought the females thought that size didn't matter.
That is...
Oh,
amazing.
My God. He does it every time, eh? I meant the size of the tractor.
That's what I meant.
Well, I mean, I don't even know what we're talking about anymore.
Just pretend we're talking about
dogs. Back to the topic at hand. I think size does matter for owners, and I think it's more of a I think some people worry more so, especially if you have a dog that's very large and then you have a small one, that they're overly concerned that the large dog might hurt the small one. And I know everybody's going to say, oh, I know a little dog that could, like, you know, they have no fear, they're great around big dogs. Absolutely, that can happen. I'm just saying that if somebody is concerned or they're not, if that makes them nervous, then that might be something to consider. that, you know, or if you have a dog that chases small animals, and why would you bring in a toy breed of dog? So you may want to think about that carefully, depending on your dog's issues and what, how they behave. You know, is it wise?
And if you have, like, a rough player, you know, even if it's maybe, if it's not a toy drive issue or whatever, but if they're one of those sort of very physical playing dogs, if it's a larger dog and you are looking at a smaller dog, that could inadvertently hurt the smaller dog.
Exactly. So that would be something to consider, you know, and those, well, and or someone else might say, hey, I don't want two big dogs. I have a big dog. He sleeps on the bed. If I get another big dog, I mean, I'm going to be kicked out of the bed, you know, or I don't have enough space in the house. How big is your house realistically for two wolfhounds? Could you do that? So you may be choosing a smaller dog just because of size issues. Is every body you add into your house, there's less space to go around. And that's something that I think some people get really blindsided by, that things are going well with one dog and it's a friendly dog, seems to be doing good. But if you put an extra body into a smaller house where there isn't room for each dog to sort of have their own space, it starts getting overly cramped and you start getting little fights over things that might not happen.
I mean, that's an interesting point in relationship to, like, introducing your two dogs. If you're introducing the dogs and, you know, it's like a neutral space and it's open and, you know, you're not sort of like operating around that living space situation where things might be a little cramped together.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a blog post recently where I read about a person, they added a third dog to their family, and the dogs had gotten along great at the previous meet and greets, but once they got into the house and had to, they were in a small area, and the one was trying to get past the other, and a fight started.
Yep.
Pinch points. Got to be careful of pinch points where they, like, sort of get pinched together too close.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Right, because it's that idea, especially when you have some of the smaller, older houses where, you know, it's cozy. I mean, that's the word I'm looking for, a cozy house.
Cozy.
You know, and it's lovely until one of the dogs is spread out sleeping across the floor, and to get around them, you have to step over them. And that's not a concern unless you add in another body. And
yeah, one of my dogs sleeps across the hallway where I sleep. So if another dog wants to come into the bedroom, they got to go around. There's not enough room. They have to jump over that dog to get through there.
And right.
She loves doing that. She loves laying there. And, you'll say, look, other dogs want to go in and out. She's like, no, I'm sticking. When the lights go out, this is where I'm laying.
Mm-hmm.
It's they all have these weird things they do, man.
Yep. And depending on how she tolerates, other dogs jumping over her would depend on how well that would work out.
Mm-hmm.
So,
she doesn't
lots
mind
of things
it.
To consider, yeah.
But I do see that some of the dogs are hesitant to do that. They'll come and they'll look and they'll go, I'm not going in there if she's laying there. And they just won't do it.
Yep.
There's not a fight about it. It's just they feel that it's not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dog rule book around here somewhere. I have to find it.
Oh, I'm sure he's got some interesting name for his dog book, too. Oh,
I'll bet
he's going to come out with his doggy rule book. Actually, it would probably be hilarious.
It would be.
It would be hysterical.
It would be.
Mm-hmm.
It would be only three dogs are allowed on the bed at once during sex. And now, you know, when you get into the bondage thing, now tough to have dogs around when that happens.
I wouldn't
think everything's a tug toy.
Oh, yeah, the ex crotch.
Wow, your aim was true on that.
Oh, that was good.
I have.
All right, well, on that note, on that true arrow shot, we shall end the show on a high note and hope that everybody stayed awake during my boring part to hear this exciting part. And we'll be back next week with another exciting and very fun edition of Pitbull and Legal News Radio. With all of it in all its glory. Hope you all have a good week. I hope all you guys are in the snow. You keep warm. And Yvette, how is it up there? Is it above
cold.
Zero?
Cold. It's too darn cold.
All right. Well, this is probably a three-dog night for you then tonight.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, everybody. Have a good night, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, Yvette.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good night.